You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Friday the 25th of August. Ko Kelly Enright Tukuingoa. I am joined in studio by my producer, Laura Quigstad. How's it going, Laura?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Pretty beautiful day today. Yeah. Well, today on the show, we've got a lot coming up. Laura speaks with the Director of the Energy at Auckland Uni, continuing on our environment policy coverage in the lead up to the election. Then we'll chat to National's Environment Policies with Andrew Bailey, the Chair of the Blue Greens Committee. Of course, we'll have Neighbourhood Watch with Nicole from Radio Adelaide, so we can keep up to date with the latest happening across the ditch. Then Will interviews Ronald Kramer on the subcultures of graffiti and artistic expression in the public sphere. Finally, to celebrate National Poetry Day. Did you know it was National Poetry Day today, Laura?
I didn't. It
is. It's National Poetry Day. So we've got an amazing interview that Amanda did with Selena Marsh, who is the first Pacific Islander to graduate with a PhD in English from the University of Auckland, and she has just released her latest collection of poetry. Remember, if you've got anything you'd like to add throughout the show, just give me a text on 5395. If you want to comment on anything we're chatting about, you can give us a text or even a call on 309-387.
The Ballot Build-Up on 95BFM.
So following on from our earlier coverage throughout the week, we've been discussing environment and policies leading up to the election. Today I spoke with Director of Energy at Auckland University, Basil Sharp, and I asked him to explain the state of energy within New Zealand.
In terms of electricity, New Zealand is really well positioned in moving into sustainable electricity production. I mean, currently we're sitting at around 80% of our electricity is coming from renewable sources, and the work that we've been doing, if we include additional investment in wind, geothermal, and with increased solar penetration, I think we're well positioned to reach government's target of 90% by 2025.
And so what are these unrenewable sources that we're going to at the minute?
Well, the non-renewables, and these are going to be important, so importantly gas. So as we increase our reliability on intermittent sources such as wind and solar in the future, then we are going to need dispatchable electricity, and that's going to be mainly from wind, but increasingly we're going to rely upon our hydro system too, because hydro lakes can kind of act as a kind of a battery when our wind is not blowing and the sun is not shining.
And how does the non-renewable gas impact our environment?
In terms of greenhouse gas emissions, gas relative to coal contributes less to our CO2 emissions. So I think, and then when you balance that out against the emissions that come from geothermal, which are very low, wind basically none, solar none, hydro none, you know, in terms of the average, it's very, very low.
And why do you think it is that we're still resorting to these kinds of non-renewable sources?
Well, we really need gas as a dispatchable source. So, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, if the wind is not blowing, I mean, our wind capacity in New Zealand, they currently operate at about 45% of the time, so relative to other countries, we're really well placed. Our wind resources are in comparison with other countries, are outstanding. And so there's great potential there. But for that, 50% of the time when we can't rely on wind, or the wind farms are not injecting electricity into the grid, then we're going to have to rely on other sources, and that's where gas comes into play.
So I know this isn't your area of expertise, but politically, how do you think energy is coming into play leading up to the political election?
Well, I think the big challenge I think that we have in New Zealand, the current challenge, is in the distribution of electricity, and our lines companies that have built their business models around distributing electricity to households and end users. The world is changing, so we're moving into a digital environment where smart metering comes into play. We've got situations where households now are investing in solar electricity or solar energy, and building business models in a cope with these distributed sources of electricity and the digital environment that we're moving into, I think is going to be a big challenge for lines companies going forward. And so that's going to have implications for policy and issues around pricing, access to resources and so on.
Mm-hmm. There was an issue a little while back in which solar users petitioned an extra tax and lost that. Is that something that you think has grounds?
I don't see a role here for government intervention other than creating a playing field where people that are generating electricity for their own personal consumption is fine. If they want to feed their surplus back into the local networks, then I think it's reasonable that the lines companies can extract a charge for the utilization of their assets. I don't see a role for taxes, subsidies in this particular area at all. I think we should be relying upon market mechanisms and fair pricing with respect to the utilisation of resources.
That was Basil Sharp from the Energy Centre. And after the break, we won't be turning to Jamie Lee today. We'll be talking to Andrew Bailey, who is the chair of the Blue Greens Committee. He'll be joining us live to chat about all the environmental policies from National. Also, 5395 is the number to text if you have any thoughts on the topics I'll be talking to Andrew about up next.
Flying Out and 95BFM present the Others Way Festival, Friday, September 1st, all around Kay Road. The best of New Zealand is coming to Kay Road with Beck Runga, Lawrence Arabia, The Courtneys, Micronism, Sneaky Feelings and heaps more. The Others Way 2017. Tickets from Flying Out and online at flyingout.co.nz and undertheradar.co.nz. Limited early bird tickets available. Thanks to Karma Cola, Coffee Supreme, Kate Sylvester, Kay Road Business Association, Going Global Music Summit, Garage Project, APRA AMCOS NZ, One Music and Phantom Bill Stickers.
BFM News.
Afternoon.
Sleet. Ah,
pressure system.
Are you wearing the right amount of layers?
Sorry.
Sleet.
Ah. Nice one. Another classic 95 BFM moment and an incredibly opportune moment to cut to an even more classic 95 BFM ad break. Let's face it, most of you are only actually listening to the ads these days anyway. We write them ourselves, we make them ourselves, and we sometimes do a little bit of accidental wheeze laughing at them ourselves. If you'd like our culturally savvy, hyper-intelligent, extremely good-looking audience to magically become your audience, all while supporting an independent broadcasting institution, give us a toot on 309-4831. And marvel at how easy, affordable, and effective it can be. Where do we do poos? Who cares? Where do you do poos? Let's find out.
It's time for our weekly political chat with the National Party's Jamie Lee Ross.
Andrew Bailey, how are you going today?
Oh, very good, Kelly.
Good. Sorry about that intro. Not actually you today, but no. Not actually Jamie Lee. So I just wanted to get straight into some of National's coming up election policies that they're announcing to do with the environment. So obviously fresh water is a big one this election. So we know through nationwide protests and presence of activist groups like Bung Labor that a critical question that a lot of Kiwis are wanting the answer to is why water bottle corporations can take our fresh water and export it without having to pay royalties.
Yeah, so it's always been the case that people can use water and for various different activities. What we've seen is that a number of new companies come in who are taking over existing consents. So we're concerned about it, and what we've done is we've asked a group to look at it in more detail. It's on the face of it sounds bad, but to how you deal with it is the issue, because once you start saying to one particular group you have to pay a tax on it or whatever it might be, then how does that ripple? Because the issue with bottled water, if it's straight bottled water, that's fine. But a lot of the bottling companies, such as making Coca-Cola or making beer, they use large volumes of water as well. So getting a clear definition around it is quite a difficult issue, and that's why we've asked the technical group to look into it.
So the public sentiment, I think, here is not about maybe the quantity or the statistics, but it's the sense that something precious, you know, in New Zealand that is being exploited for commercial gain, and there's no benefits coming back to New Zealand communities or back into the water bodies that are being extracted from. So just wondering how National feels about, yeah, not, you know, taking a very scarce resource from New Zealanders and there not being any sort of repayment for that.
Yeah, so you've just raised the issue, which is, if it's a foreign-owned bottling company, should they be paying a tax or a royalty on it? If it's a locally-owned bottling company, should they? And so you, in that introduction, that's just what you raised there. So the issue is, how do you work through that? And so on the face of it, it's a very easy issue, and we all understand the public sentiment. But actually, when you start to get in underneath it, you need to work out where the point of differentiation. So if we end up saying, let's stop foreign owners taking New Zealand water and sending it overseas, that's pretty easy. Are you going to just do with bottled water or carbonated water, or are you going to now talk about other drinks? Because a lot of our bottling companies are also owned overseas, but they supply the New Zealand market. So is it just the New Zealand portion, or is it the overseas portion? That's why I'm saying the issue is a little bit more complicated than most people think. But we understand the sentiment. We understand the issue that people are worried about.
So also, talking about how you're going to plan to clean up rivers and lakes to make them swimmable, so we're we're moving to a system which requires councils to improve the swimmability of their rivers and lakes over the year. And so under your new proposal, over 50,000 kilometres of waterways will be improved for swimming, which we will see more places that are suitable for swimming more often. How do you plan on doing this?
Well, let's go back to a little bit of stuff. So, Kelly, it wasn't until we introduced the measurement of water that suddenly the issue became apparent. And so all this debate now about water quality has only become about because National Party introduced required measurement of water quality bodies around New Zealand. Because that then gives you the position, the start point to actually work out which are the waterways that are clean and which are the dirty. So that's been the most important thing that National's done, is actually bringing this issue out into the public fore. Mm-hmm. What we've require now of councils is that we have specified the minimum level, and where we set it is that we require 90% of all rivers and lakes to be swimmable by 2040. Now, most people don't understand what that means, but that the level that we've introduced, it takes into account E. coli and all the different other things, nitrates and water, is actually on par with the best European standards. So the New Zealand standard is on par with the European standards for water. And what we're requiring councils now to do is go away and measure their water quality each of their waterways and their catchment areas. And if it is below that minimum requirement, which the government has specified, they then have a requirement either to do something about it or actually required to go and consult with the community as to why they're going to keep it below that minimum specified level, and that's for the community to make that decision. So this is a way of making sure that councils start to really address this question very quickly. Now, alongside that, the government's put up $400 million, and it's already been investing. In fact, we only announced a couple of weeks ago another $44 million to going up, cleaning up specific lakes and rivers, and was part of a $100 million fund that we're allocating. And also, apart from the $400 million that the government's put up, it's estimated that farmers across New Zealand have voluntarily spent another $500 million already cleaning up many of the waterways in the rural areas. The only other point I'd say to you, people focus on the agriculture sector. Unfortunately, many of our urban waterways are also suffering from poor water quality.
So what is your stance, obviously, speaking on the agricultural side and a lot of people thinking that that's the main problem. So Labor has said that they will introduce a levy on irrigation for, and you know, a lot of farmers are unhappy about that. What's your stance on that?
Well, I represent the electorate of Hinua, which is all the vegetable growing area of Pukekohe, Bombay, all those beautiful red soils that you see. And I can tell you that the growers in my area are very, very concerned about it, because we don't know what the tax is that Labor are proposing. At one point, one member was saying it was going to be a lot higher, and now they've come back and said it's only going to be a few cents. We don't know. And, of course, that's all up for conjecture until after the election, when they're going to get together and make a decision. So my growers are very, very concerned about it, because the impact will be that you and I, when we go into the vegetable shop and buy onions, potatoes, whatever, which are all grown out in Pukekohe, you will be paying a higher price for it. Now, their argument is we should tax these people and we'll use the money. At the moment, most of these farmers and growers, and I know them, I've been around many of their properties, are doing a tremendous amount. There's precision farming now, that means that water's not wasted, agriculture use is minimised, fertiliser applications are minimised to the extent possible, and they are progressively moving to it. And as I said before, $500 million has been invested by the industry. So it's really a question of approach. We don't want to tax people, because that's going to hit you and I in the back pocket when we go to the supermarket.
So moving on to climate change, National's climate change vision, the New Zealand Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment is calling on the government to instate a climate change commission that will be a watchdog of sorts in making sure New Zealand remains on target with the commitments it made in the Paris Agreement. And all other parties in Parliament have agreed that it would be beneficial to have this independent and transparent commission. But is this something that National would look to establish, as they haven't actually voiced any support for that?
Yeah, so I co-chair the Blue Greens, which is the National Party environmental group, and that's made up of nearly half of all our MPs who have an active involvement in the Blue Greens movement. I'm also a member of Globe, and we have a number of National Party MPs who sit on the Globe party, which is, your listeners probably don't know what that means. So there is a cross-party group of all MPs from all the parties who have come together and have looked at all the different issues around climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the proposals is that we adopt this UK model, where there's an independent group that sets targets way out into the future and then gives that to the government of the day, and the government of the day then works out how they're going to meet the decreasing carbon targets that this group determine.
Mm-hmm.
We're an active member of that. In fact, Honourable Paula Bennett, she's met with our group. And in fact, it was the National Party Blue Greens group that invited Lord Devon out earlier this year to come to our conference, where we had 200 to 300 people, to talk about how this arrangement works. So we're actively engaged in the debate. And I'm well aware of the Parliamentary Commission of Environment's report on it. I've read it and listened to her presentation. And so the best thing about this is that MPs from across the House are working collaboratively, because this shouldn't be seen as a political issue from every 3 years. This is a long-term issue, and we need to get it right for all New Zealanders.
Yeah, agreed, because I think obviously that the New Zealand Parliamentary Commission is saying that the Paris Agreement isn't a binding agreement, so obviously we need something that will be an incentive for successive governments to make this a priority. And I think that's the idea behind this commission, is that it's transparent and it's separate from the state. Is that not something that National wants to endorse?
Yeah, I might correct you a little bit, because we've committed. New Zealand was one of the first to sign up to the Paris Accord. So Paula was one of the first to fly over and ratified it. Needed a minimum of 56 countries to ratify it. We were in that first batch of countries. So New Zealand took a leadership role, and we've signed up to the 30% decrease in emissions based on 2005 levels to be achieved by 2030. We have now agreed to do that as a country. So that's not, we can't backtrack from that. What this group has been set up in England does is it actually takes a long-term view on how countries and the UK carbon emissions are tracking. and then it makes sure that measures are going to report back to public in the public domain, so everyone knows what's going on. But the tactics around how it's achieved is for the government of the day to actually determine what incentives they put in place or what other investments they put in place to make that transition to a lower carbon economy.
So currently New Zealand has no greenhouse gas targets in law, and putting climate change targets into legislation makes current and future governments more accountable for, you know, reducing emissions, and that will be sort of a follow-on incentive. Is National looking at putting anything in law for this as a priority?
But again, that's what we've signed up with the Paris Accord. So we've set...
That's not obviously legislation. I'm thinking, you know, national policy in our country.
Yeah, but this is the government signed the accord, signed the Paris Agreement. So it's a binding agreement. So at the moment we produce about 80 odd million tons of emissions a year. And what we're trying to do is to decrease that over time. And we've got the target is we have to meet, and what we've signed up to do is to reduce that by 30%, the 2005 level, by 2030. So it's quite an ambitious target. It's going to take a lot of investment to get there.
We're also looking, National has said, we're also looking at how we can reduce emissions in other sectors such as agriculture and transport. How are you guys going about that at the moment?
Well, we've already targeted air emissions. Jet planes actually produce reasonably high emissions. We've also just recently put in place a banning over time of hydrochlorofluorocarbons, which are a really potent gas. So everyone talks about methane. These ones are a couple of hundred times more severe than the normal type of gas that's emitted. So we're doing that. We've targeted introducing a significant amount of new electric vehicles into it and using the government as the lever to do that. So we want to get 64,000 cars, electric cars, on the road by 2021. And recently we've announced that the government's going to take a role of that. Because by buying the first of those cars, what that does is opens up the second-hand market for that. And then that's how we're going to get more cars across the fleet, because at the moment we have a very slow turnover of the national fleet in New Zealand. Mm. And the other area, of course, the investment that's been put into public transport, particularly rail, is significant. So just recently we've announced in the last budget, nearly $1 billion into rail, and we've just announced that if we get into office, we'll be doing further electrifications down to my area in Pukekohe, triple laning in the rail link between Westfield and Wiri and Auckland, and further electrification down in Wellington. So there's a big investment going to public transport, and that's another way of doing that.
So
and
another
on top of that is
the other side of that question, kind of was the agricultural part. Obviously,
yep.
Agriculture is the highest. Well, in 2015, was
true.
The highest greenhouse gas emitter in New Zealand, and that takes up about half the amount of the greenhouse gas emissions in New Zealand.
Yep.
Is there something in place or going to be put in place?
Yeah, and you're right. Greenhouse emissions from agriculture accounts for just under half. What New Zealand's doing, what our approach is that we want to be a world leader in reducing agricultural emissions. And what we've done is we've partnered with what's called the Global Alliance Research, and we're putting a significant amount of money into that, because we believe that there's a lot of countries working on things like how do you reduce transport emissions and all those other different types of emissions. We believe we can be a world leader in taking the research into reducing emissions from agriculture. So if you take a classic dairy cow, you've got a lot of emissions that come out of them belching, and obviously emissions coming out from the other end.
Mm-hmm.
But then you've got the impact of nitrous oxide that comes out of the manure and when a cow goes wheeze. And those are the areas that New Zealand is investing a lot of money. So some of the technology you're looking at is different types of plants, the grasses that produce lower methane. You also have different, if you look at the attributes of certain cattle, individual cows, you find they naturally produce less methane. So how do we have dairy cows in New Zealand that produce less methane? And then there's a whole lot of other issues, like what do you do with manure patches? If you get to them within a short period of time, and how do you treat it to reduce the emissions that come out of it? That's where we're putting a lot of emphasis and money into to make it actually happen. And if we believe we can be a world leader on that, and all the countries who've got agriculture industries around the world can adopt it.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time, Andrew. Have a lovely afternoon.
Hey, thanks, Kelly.
No worries.
That was the National Party's Jamie Lee Ross. The Wire.
Obviously not Jamie Lee, Andrew Bailey again, who is the chair of the Blue Greens Committee. After the break, we'll have Radio Adelaide's Nicole Whitting with all the latest in Australian news for Neighbourhood Watch.
Call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
How are you today, Nicole?
I'm good, thanks, Kelly. How are you?
Good. Do you sound like, does that sound anything like an Australian accent? Every time I hear that, that sting, it's Neighbourhood Watch. Does that, is that, are we getting that right?
It sounds like a very outback Australian accent.
Right. Well, we're coming to talk to you about Melbourne today, a second Melbourne Council voting to cancel Australia Day. So Councillor Trent McCarthy, who moved the motion, said changing the date was about acknowledging the extreme hurt felt by the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders people at celebrating a National Day, which is the day that the first fleet arrived in Sydney Cove, which some Indigenous people call Invasion Day. How's that being received in Melbourne?
I think that the population is receiving it quite well, and looking at it as a sort of activist move, really, because obviously this council, they can't change the date of Australia Day themselves. It's up to the federal government.
Mm.
But they're using it as a statement and just really to start a conversation. And they've followed a move by their neighbouring council, the Yarra Council, to change the date of the national holiday. But the federal government has responded by stripping them of their right to hold citizenship ceremonies, saying that now citizenships won't be apolitical, bipartisan and secular in these councils, which is, I think, making it's a move that makes the federal government look worse than anyone else.
So if they were to move the date, would it still be called Australia Day, or are they going to kind of change the whole celebration?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think some people would still want it to be called Australia Day, but change just the activities on the day, I guess, and make it more culturally sensitive. And then I think some people just want to scrap the day, some people want to change the name, so it's a whole debate for sure.
So when you say make it more culturally sensitive, what is culturally insensitive about the day that people are getting kind of up in arms about?
Yeah, I think just this idea of Australia was created on this day is the crux of the issue. I think that's offensive to a lot of, especially Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and just a lot of the community just don't think it's appropriate for the date the first fleet arrived to be the day that we celebrate. And so rather than kind of being ostentatious, like, I guess, with our national pride, people just want something that maybe celebrates Indigenous culture instead, or is just, the focus might be on being multicultural or something like that.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I hope that happens for them then. Another piece of news is baby boomers. The headline I thought was amazing. Baby boomers hitting the bottle and bongs at alarming levels, health experts warn. Can you explain that a little bit for us?
Yeah, sure. So researchers from the UK, the South London Maudsley NHS Foundation Trust, as well as Adelaide at Flinders University, have found that in the UK and Australia, binge drinking is on the decline among all age groups except those over the age of 40. And on top of this, Australians over 50 also have higher rates of illicit drug use than younger people, this mainly being because of a misuse of prescription drugs. So this is quite interesting, because the reason given by the researchers is that as people get older, their views towards alcohol become more liberal.
Right.
And the drug use, I think, is maybe not as surprising because, young baby boomers were young in the 60s and a lot of them are using cannabis. And I think the misuse of illicit drugs, like the prescription drugs and things like that, a consequence is they're probably just using more prescription drugs in general,
right,
than younger people. So, the study, I guess, at least is for a good cause. Like, there's talks of more education campaigns to help older drug users, and an increase in alcohol screening because they're not, people don't predict that they're, or people don't expect them to be binge drinkers. They're not screened as much as younger people.
Right.
So, yeah, I think there's a good outcome to the study.
Yeah, well, hopefully we see some traction made on that then.
Yeah, for sure.
Dr. John Pierce, who says he can help parents get children exempt from the Victorian law by sort of helping kids that are unvaccinated get past the system. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. He's a doctor who promotes natural healing. Yeah.
Right. So is he's under scrutiny at the moment from Australia's health watchdog?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So the Australian Health Practitioner Regulation Agency is reportedly investigating him. Because there was a video that came out this week where he basically explained how he gets away with not giving children vaccinations. So he writes doctor's letters to parents, and these parents are conscientious objectors to vaccinations. So you are allowed to not get your children vaccinated if there is medical reason, if there's proof they're going to be fully immunised in the future. But having a moral objection doesn't count. But there is obviously a lot of anti-vaccination groups around, and a lot of parents do want to object to it, whether it's for the pain that it causes their children or other reasons. But in Victoria, there's this legislation called No Jab, No Play, which basically means that children can't be enrolled in early childhood daycare or education unless they are immunised.
Mm. And has he been helping them kind of sidestep that?
Yeah, exactly. And on top of that, there's federal legislation too, which withholds family payments for parents who don't immunise their kids. So, yeah, he's been trying to help people get around this for a while, reportedly.
So it says, obviously, that he's under scrutiny from from the health watchdog. Is there going to be any kind of legal implications upon him, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think that he would be subject to some sort of legal action if he is found to have been doing this. But it's been a long time because a year ago he was first revealed to be an anti-vaccination doctor, and you know, the same regulator recommended that he go back and get further education since then. But then, you know, he's still making these comments this week, so I don't know how likely it is that action will happen in the near future, because it just seems to be a cycle, and there's other doctors who have been caught up in this in the past as well.
Mm. Well, we might have an update on that next week then.
Yeah.
If anything's happened. Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us, Nicole. Talk
no
to you
worries.
Next week.
Speak to you soon.
See ya.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper.
You are tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. So if you've got anything to say about anything we've talked about, anything to do with the environment, please text in to 5395 and I'd love to hear what you have to say. And next up, graffiti is one of those topics which tends to be very polarising when it comes to discussing legality as well as its aesthetic place within society and culture. So Auckland University's Ronald Kramer is somebody who has investigated subcultures and their place in society with a specific focus on graffiti culture and artistic expression in the public sphere. 95BFM reporter Will Parsonson spoke to Ronald about these discussions and critiques around graffiti and public art, which he will present in an upcoming talk for Auckland's Raising the Bar event next week. Will started by asking Ronald why it was in the interest of those in power to suppress this artistic deviance and societal escapism.
Well, I would say there's a handful of reasons as to why they embrace anti-graffiti positions. I think it has a lot to do with articulating a certain vision of the urban environment and communicating whose interests sort of will ultimately be served in the way we think about public and urban space. So to be more specific, I guess I would say part of it is about commodifying the urban environment and turning it into a place that's sort of panders to middle class and upper class interests. Things like tourism industries, business industries. So I think that kind of anti-graffiti position supports those kinds of interests ultimately.
So would you say that in terms of graffiti, it's sort of a reactionary deviance to this idea of this, the cultural and the social setting being that for the middle class and upper class? You think that graffiti is a way of countering this issue?
Some people have made that argument. They see in graffiti a cultural politics, and I think you could make that argument by default. Graffiti is in the public space, it's in the urban environment, and so it's going to have some meaning and significance when it's in that space. But I don't know that you'll necessarily find that view amongst a lot of graffiti writers. I think most graffiti writers just want to paint and express their creativity.
So do you think it's more about the creation itself than the act of defying sort of social norms?
For a lot of the graffiti writers, I would say yes. Their primary interest is in the creativity of it and the painting aspect of it. You certainly have some people in the culture that are more about sort of rebellion and sort of the experience of illegality. You certainly have that side of it. But I would say that's become a relatively minor part of a lot of graffiti writing these days.
So in terms of sort of tagging and getting people, I mean, a lot of graffiti artists talk about getting up in a city. I know in Wellington it's sort of about getting up, getting your name in specific areas. Is that a driving force behind the reason they do this? Or, like you say, is it more to do with the art?
So certainly, again, a big part of it for some people will be sort of getting up and getting the name out there. But I think even that, I think oftentimes we think that that side of graffiti has no creative aspect. But I would actually say it does. A lot of the energy that goes into tagging is, believe it or not, driven by aesthetic concerns. So people spend a lot of time working on that to perfect it, to make it look a certain way, and there is a certain skill to it. There's also a creativity to that in the way that where people put the name, how they get it there, things like that. But it is a bit of a different outside of graffiti. I think you've got a lot of things going on in graffiti writing culture. It's very complicated. But what I would say is you can't just reduce it to its illegality and its desire to break the law.
So it is, in a sense, it's more about the subculture itself and the people acting within that subculture than rebelling against a force above them or a different part of society.
I would think so. That would be my interpretation of it. The primary motivation is around being creative. It's an engagement with other subcultural members. I think you can read a politics into it, and I certainly think that's valid. But the question is, do you find that at the forefront of the graffiti writer's mind, and is that the kind of thing they would articulate in their experience? That you don't find so often.
So I've read that you've done studies on graffiti in New York. If you could tell me about that.
Yeah, so the studies on... So the work was based on sort of graffiti writing in New York, that the book that's come out. And I guess the reason why I sort of got into that and did that was because there's a lot of books on graffiti now that assume illegality and talk about graffiti as an illegal subculture. But one of the things that's happened in the 1990s and onwards is the rise of legal graffiti. No one has really actually written about that in any detail or produced a book about it, which is somewhat odd because it's now, I would say, it's the main form of graffiti writing, and it's the form that has the most visual impact. And I think it's generally changed the way a lot of people think about graffiti and street art, so on and so forth. So that's really what the book is about. It's about this new form of graffiti writing that forces us to rethink those old sort of conceptions of graffiti. So one of those conceptions, for example, would be, oh, this is illegal, it's about resistance, it's about rejection of mainstream norms or something. Actually, the opposite. A lot of the guys and women who paint legally, they want to work with cities, they want to work within the urban environment and communities to enhance them and make them more visually interesting.
So when you say legal graffiti, do you mean sort of mural artists and people who are commissioned to paint on buildings and things like that?
That might be a part of it, but the more common strand of legal graffiti is aesthetic forms that are consistent with graffiti as we typically know it. That's a bit of an odd way to put it. But they are produced with permission of property owners or in ways that don't violate the law. Now, oftentimes that's not commissioned. It's just people seeking permission in order to paint whatever they want to paint. They're just basically asking people for a canvas to just go and paint. And so typically in those conditions they're given free rein, but there's no money exchange.
Because I know a few, but locals in New York and other cities around the world are sort of embracing the culture of graffiti and making it sort of part of the city. It's sort of the grungy sort of culture that it's associated with has sort of become a sort of lifeblood of some of these cities.
Absolutely. Yeah, so and I think that's got a lot to do with the rise of legal graffiti and sort of the crossover into street art and stuff like that. So I think a lot of cities have realized, oh, it's more effective to incorporate the graffiti writers and the street artists and work with the talent, right? This is why I think it's so important to recognize this is creative energy, and the typical state response is to suppress it, make it illegal, and punish. Whereas if you were smart about it, I would say you would work with what these people are doing because they make a lot of urban environments much more interesting. Wellington, for example, is way cooler than Auckland. Anybody with half a brain knows that or sees that the minute you go to Wellington, right? And I would say that that has a lot to do with the presence of street art, the sort of, it has more of a grungy feel, right? There's more of a sense of freedom. It just makes it a more interesting urban space.
Yeah, I'm a Wellington boy myself, and I'm sure a lot of listeners hearing that will go, no way, Wellington doesn't even compare to Auckland. But I've got a soft spot myself. And it's awesome, especially in Wellington, to look up above, you know, even above Mount Victoria Tunnel and places like that, and places that you'd never expect anyone to go, and seeing someone's name tagged up there, and you think that dude is just crazy, whoever that was.
Yeah, it's kind of a nice surprise, right? Like, if you roll with it and you sort of get it, you get it, and you recognize how it could be incorporated. I think there's a lot of spaces in the city where you could have graffiti. It doesn't really matter. There's a lot of public spaces that are pretty mundane, and so I would say you just let people paint those. You don't worry about those too much. I understand not wanting graffiti on things like historic buildings and statues and things of that nature, but a lot of the space is mundane. And so I think that's a big difference between Auckland and Wellington, right? Auckland cleans everything, right? And that's what makes it such a boring city, visually speaking. And that's why Wellington is cooler.
So you say there's sort of, you don't want people drawing on historic buildings, and that's sort of, you know, a fair assumption, but where do you draw the line, and how do you prevent that if normal or just casual other graffiti is encouraged, or not encouraged, but allowed?
So what I think, if I was the city and thinking about policy in these respects, like currently, for example, Auckland spends about $4.5 to $5 million on graffiti removal. I would work with a more subtle typology. So I would create legal spaces to paint. I would think about semi-legal zones. In other words, that's zones of high tolerance. So, you know, mundane physical infrastructure that's not that important. You don't spend money painting over that. And then you have a sense of zero tolerance where you won't tolerate graffiti. And the borderline is that would be up for debate, but in those zero tolerance zones, you would use your typical removal policing strategies to control that. So, you know, I think things like historic buildings, public statues, fairly off limits, and the goal of doing that would be to channel and funnel the creativity into outlets that are actually useful for the city.
Yeah, I mean, that'd be super cool, and it would sort of allow this art to flourish in a healthy and progressive way rather than just being shut down. Because like I was saying earlier, there are, well, from what I've seen, there are artists and graffiti artists who do graffiti just to, you know, like stick it to the man or stick it to society or something. I know in New York that there are artists who will just go out in broad daylight in the middle of a road and just paint over someone's garage just for the sake of it, just for making that statement that they can do what they want.
Yeah, you've got that element, but I would say even in New York, a roll down shutter, for example, is a pretty mundane space. So if I was a property owner in those respects, I wouldn't worry too much about that. When the business is open, it rolls up, you can't see it. There's a lot of business owners who don't care about the roll-down shutter, for example. But yeah, I understand. You certainly sort of do still have that element. But I think the way I'm thinking about it, the way I'm suggesting we think about it, is actually not that crazy. It probably sounds a bit crazy, but we do this in all kinds of ways. So Auckland has a lot of skate parks, for example, right? But then you also see ways in which they've built physical infrastructure to prevent skateboarding, so the little metal bits in seats and things so they can't slide across. But it works. You channel all those skateboarders into skate parks and things like that, and it's awesome. That subculture has a space. I would say there's no reason why graffiti can't be thought of in a similar way.
Yeah, they're both artistic expressions in a sense. So I was going to ask, you're doing a presentation for Raise the Bar Auckland. When is that, and what is it about?
So the Raise the Bar presentation is on August 29 at 6:30, and it's at Fort Street. Union, I think, is the place. And it's basically about all this stuff. So it's essentially about the massive change in graffiti writing culture that's occurred in the last, since the 1990s, and about the persistent nature of state opposition, and how that might not actually be the best way to think about graffiti and street art.
So that was indeed Ronald Kramer talking to producer Will about his upcoming talk for the Auckland event Raising the Bar, which is a series of talks presented by a variety of academics and professionals discussing interesting commentaries on everything from society to space travel. All the talks will happen in bars across Auckland on the 29th of August. Tickets can be found online at Raising the Bar.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Solid Entertainment presents The XX, Thursday, January the 11th at Trusts Arena. One of the most in-demand bands on the planet. The magnificent, the magical, The XX. Returning to New Zealand for the first time in 8 years. The XX, live at the Trusts Arena, Thursday, January the 11th.
Tickets on sale today from Ticketek.
Be there.
Get to grips with the intricate ballot ballet. Get your head around the persistent policy patter. Look towards possible political predicaments.
The Ballot Build-Up is your place for everything election 2017. Every day we're speaking to our listeners, to politicians and to thinkers at the forefront of the issues that matter. The environment, education, justice, the future of work and economy, health and livability. You'll have democracy sussed.
The Ballot Build-Up. Weekdays on The Wire right up until the election. Only on 95BFM.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
Today is National Poetry Day. The first Pacific Islander to graduate with a PhD in English from the University of Auckland, Dr. Selena Marsh, has just released her latest collection of poetry. The latest collection is called Tightrope and is an ongoing dialogue on memory, life, and death to find out whether stories can cure the incurable. 95BFM reporter Amanda Robinson spoke with Selena about her recent book release.
When did you start writing the collection?
Well, it seems to be about every 4 years that a collection comes out. So Fast Talking PI was 2009 and then Dark Spiring was 2013 and our Tightrope is 2017. So I didn't plan it that way. It's like my kids. I didn't plan that they'd be 18 months apart. But life happens around them now. So I guess life happens around the writing as well, the poetry.
Did you kind of go into it thinking that they would all be in a collection, or at what point in writing the poems did you kind of start to put them together?
Probably when I had about 250 of them. So I don't write, you know, I don't write towards a particular manuscript with a particular kind of theme or manuscript in mind. I just kind of practice writing as a way of being, and then when it's like you know, you herd enough sheep together and you actually get a flock and so it's like, oh, actually this looks like, you know, they're crowding around certain themes and that you could actually kind of see one through line or one story that might hold together quite a range of different kinds of poems or sheep, if you like.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there is that in reading it, you can tell kind of that through line. But then you also have kind of separated it into three segments, Abyss, Tightrope and Trick. How did you kind of go about deciding which poems belong to each section?
Yeah, you know, it's so funny because oftentimes you don't know what you've written until you've written it and then given it a bit of space to be itself and to speak to you in different ways across various periods of your life. And you know, like, it kind of operates on the principle of contiguity, right? So you put two what seem to be dissimilar or unlike things side by side, and if you put them there long enough, you can actually see connections there. And that's the beauty of being a poet and a creative writer, is that you needn't overdetermine the connections, you just let them rise to the surface. And so knowing that, you know, Moa Laival, Albert Wendt's quote was, like, would not let me go, you know, since it was published in the late 80s, it's always been one of those quotes that I've returned to over time. Knowing that that somehow was in the middle of it, things started gravitating towards those three words, which is in that quote that opens up the collection. So it kind of, yeah, on the principle of contiguity and connection, it just started moving towards each other, so that there was kind of, yeah, it made sense to have these particular poems all together. Mind you, you know, the 40 or so poems means that, you know, just over 200 poems weren't included in the collection because they simply didn't speak strong enough to what I was trying to, kind of the direction I was trying to move in.
And like you mentioned, the 250, like that's a lot of poems. How do you narrow that down? Like over that span of time, obviously. Do you sit down and write out a bunch of poems, or do you ever sit down and write a full poem, or does it come more slowly than that?
That's a really good question. But you know, I think as a poet, like, so my kind of identity label is that I'm a Pacifica poet scholar, and there's a hyphen in between the poet and the scholar. So when I'm working and researching with critical material, I get to know it more intimately by writing poetry about it. So poetry is the way that I know not only my critical material but the world around me. It's how I remember poetry itself is, you know, kind of the trick, right? The self is the trick of memory, I think the words read. I don't have it in front of me, but it's like we choose, as Albert says, we are what we remember. And so poetry is a way of remembering moments in time and experiences. And I think it's the poems that won't quite let you go, they always go through to the second round, you know. But writing poetry is kind of as natural to me as writing a letter to myself or, you know, writing an email. There's no big fancy kind of lead up to it. It's what I do. I scribble it on the back of serviettes and in notebooks and on my laptop, you know, wherever there's space, wherever there's an experience I want to capture, that it just goes down there. And then if it still calls to me at the end of the day or at the end of the week or at the end of the month, then I begin kind of the drafting process, and then I put more energy towards really pulling that poem out.
And you mentioned sometimes it's like a letter to yourself. Do you have an addressee in mind when you're writing?
Yeah, that's another really good question. Gosh, you've researched this, haven't you? Sometimes and sometimes not. Like, I like to see myself as a poet of the people, and I get a lot of commissioned work. And so in commissioned work, you definitely are writing for a reader or a particular audience or a particular purpose. But even in those commissioned works, the poem needs to be a process of discovery. So, you know, we had the American poet Miriam Berush come and talk to our MCW students last week, and she was, you know, she said that poetry isn't about saying something, it's about discovering something. And I really had to wrestle with that, because a lot of my poetry seeks to say something, it seeks to connect and to move people. But I figured out what she was really saying is that to have an overt agenda from beginning to end kind of takes away the creative ethos of the poem itself. But to begin with something in mind and then to follow the language and the images that you find yourself laying down and to trust in the poem itself, that's where the process of discovery takes place.
Beautiful.
Have I wandered sufficiently away from your question?
No, it's perfect. It's great. And you also perform your poetry as well. Do you, when you're writing, do you read your poems aloud to yourself?
Absolutely. It's crucial. I mean, often the poems begin with me reciting or saying something out loud, because the word is a living thing and it's an embodied thing. And just because it ends up on the page doesn't mean that the embodied word doesn't have its own energy when you speak it out. And, you know, I mean, I'll speak out my poetry to living things and inanimate objects. It doesn't matter, you know. It's kind of me hearing what it sounds like in the air is really vital. And, you know, I'm preparing to MC for the New Zealand Booksellers Awards tomorrow night. So this is the industry awards where publishers and bookshop owners get acknowledged. And I'm opening up with a poem that I'm writing for them. I'm going to surprise them with it. And it's just remarkable how it's just taken on a life of its own. So I've got kind of, I know roughly where I want to go, but the poem that, you know, just when I was working on it this morning, I just thought, wow, this is really cool. It's unfolding in its own way. And, you know, I just want, because I find, you know, awards evenings, competitions are always really problematic, you know, for the majority of the people who sit in that room and don't get acknowledged that way. And so I know that I wanted the poem to acknowledge the beautiful work that everybody contributes to in making books kind of a vibrant part of our cultural life. And that's where the poem took me in the end. It was amazing.
Oh, that's
I'm not saying that I amaze myself, but that the poem amazed me.
Yeah, absolutely. And just lastly, you said that this book, in the book, you were trying to find out if stories really can cure the incurable. Have you found some sort of an answer to that?
Well, I think the most important thing is that we believe or we have faith that that is actually possible. And when it comes down to the nitty-gritty, the stories that you tell yourself are the most important thing, right, for good or for bad. And so believing in that, I've got to believe that, you know, the stories we tell ourselves and the people around us and the community around us and the globe around us do have the potential to cure the incurable, because then we're in the realm of the imagination, and that's limitless. Come on down to the Whale on National Poetry Day from 4:30 onwards next Friday and celebrate walking on a tightrope with me.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
That was indeed The Wire for Friday, the 25th of August. Kia ora rawa atu. Thank you to everybody who came on the show today, including Basil Sharp, Andrew Bailey, Ronald Kramer, and Dr. Selena Marsh. Thank you also to Laura, who is sitting right here next to me. How are you feeling, Laura?
I'm pretty good. How are you, Kelly?
Yeah, I'm pretty good. Thank you to everybody who texted into us. And everybody that came in to listen. So Murray's up next. I'm Kelly Enright, and enjoy your weekend.